All the way through the class, I've mentioned that this is meant to be extremely practical. You should be finding things in the class that you can apply immediately. And some of those are kind of procedural things, like I think this four-step process for creativity is something when you have a problem you're approaching and you need a creative solution to it, those four steps of research first, understanding the problem completely, then incubation, a time to mull it over, let it congeal, and then a step of illumination or discovery, and then finally an assessment or evaluation of whether that works or not. That four-step process is classic. That's something you can go out and apply to any problem you're trying to solve. Also, the sort of triptych that we were using in the first half of the class of values, vision, design. How do you go about solving a problem? Well, first you think back because it's an indeterminate problem. I'm not going to find that solution wholly within the problem. So I need to look to values. And values, I need to understand, what do I believe in? What do I think is important here? Values, and then values lead to vision, a kind of overall conceptual idea of where that might go. And then you design a way to get there. So those are both just tools, really concrete, process-oriented kinds of tools to help you be better at creative problem solving. But then there also are parts of the course that are maybe more implicit. It's more about training yourself to be a more creative person by bigger, broader characteristics in your life and in the way you conduct your life. So things like Richard Florida talks about an experiential life. You know, how do you lead an experiential life? You just stimulate yourself with lots of different experiences. And that helps you be a more creative person because it's easier to think outside the box when you've had some experiences that are diverse and that don't just lead you in a very conventional way. Now, that's not like, okay, I'm starting to solve this problem, what steps do I go through? That's in a bigger sense, how am I making myself the kind of person who has ideas? And that's in part by having an experiential life. So these are more implicit, and they have to do with more of lifestyle and how you run your life. Those four things at the end of the lecture a week ago that Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi said, there are four things you can do to develop this kind of personality of a creative person. And it was that, you know, make sure that you do something that surprises you every day. Get yourself some new experience. You know, walk to class a different way. Do some activity you've never done before. You need to constantly surprise yourself. Or the other thing he says, you know, constantly surprise someone else. You've got expected behavior that your friends and people who know you are accustomed to. You know, do something a little different that they don't expect and assess the reaction of that. These are, again, things that you do in a more implicit sense, in a broader sense, to stimulate yourself to be a more creative thinker. There are two books that I'm super keen on. We don't have readings out of either of these because it's not like a chapter I can pull loose from them. But one is a book by a neuroscientist named David Eagleman, and it's called Implicit. And it's all about your unconscious brain, that part of your brain that is, you're not using it consciously, but it is controlling your behavior. We've talked about that before. You're training that unconscious brain. You're not just training your conscious brain, but you're shaping your unconscious brain. And it's important that you are aware of how what you do and what experiences you have shape your unconscious brain. This other book is Subliminal, and that is, again, talking about what are those things that are happening without you necessarily being conscious of it, but subliminally, it's giving you the ability to have an insight or see a possibility in a problem that you wouldn't have seen otherwise. How do you make your brain have those ideas, and it's the subliminal part of your brain. It's the unconscious part of the brain. So in the second half of the class, we're going to be doing a lot more talking about how do we train our brains to be more creative. And the week after spring break, we have a reading and we have a lecture that's on neuroplasticity, this whole notion of you make your brain what you want it to be. Because it's, and this is all neuroscience, which has developed very rapidly in the last decade, two decades. But the understanding that it's not like you're born with a certain brain, you are constantly making neuronal connections. And those neuronal connections are made on the basis of two things. Neurons that fire together wire together, meaning that if you demand something of your brain, it will make that neuronal connection. And the more that you fire it, demand it, then it's wired together, and then you have that capability in your brain. And the other thing is use it or lose it. Then if you don't exercise that capability, then your brain will detach those neuronal connections, and it'll go on to make another neuronal connection. But your brain is doing that all the time, and you're shaping the kind of brain you have. So we're going to be very conscious of how do you shape yourself a more creative brain. And these things Csikszentmihalyi is talking about, both his suggestions about here are ways to give yourself a more creative personality, and those characteristics are really things that you're either creating those neuronal connections that support that, or you're not creating those neuronal connections that support that. Now, I'm going to run through a little bit of an argument here of why that is so important, and that it's been important for the entire existence of humankind. But now we understand it. And before, human beings were just kind of plodding through, maybe not understanding it so well. But we talked about the historical perspective in the first half of the class, and looking at the movement from an agricultural age to a mercantile age to an industrial age to the organizational age to a creative age. And I would say that in each of those periods, human beings had to have a different kind of brain. And to move to the next stage, they had to shape their brain to have a capacity that it didn't have before. And when a sufficient number of people shaped their brain to go that direction, it made the society able to advance. So in the agricultural age, people are living on the freaking farm, and they live there for generations, and nobody in your family, nobody you know, has ever been over on the other side of that mountain. You've always had your entire life, your complete existence, in this very small geographical area that you can see and you can physically experience together. Now, that is a certain mindset. Your mind thinks in a certain way. For one thing, you think extremely literally. The world is made up of what I can see. I can see this. This is the world. And it's a very small view of the world. Now, society came along and they made a technological device. And that technological device expanded the neuronal connections in people's brains. And that technological device was a map. A map was a fundamental thing that let people understand there's something beyond what I can see and experience. On the other side of that mountain, there's something else. There's a river. There's a town. And now suddenly, I don't know it because I've experienced it, but I know it because I can abstractly imagine that other thing over there because I can look at a map and I can understand spatially my world connected to another world on the other side of the mountain. The map was fundamentally a tool for expanding what the brain can do. It can imagine something abstractly that you can't experience physically. And that's a huge brain capability. But to move from the agricultural age to the mercantile age, and when you begin to think of transportation, and so, okay, on my farm here, I can raise cattle really well, but on the other side of the mountain, they've got flatter land, and they can have corn as a crop much better than I can. But I can't imagine trading that until I can spatially think of the world being bigger than this tiny thing that I experience one-on-one physically day-to-day-to-day. It's a brain capability that enabled that move from an agricultural age to a mercantile age. So the map was fundamentally a brain tool, a way of abstracting and conceptualizing space that allowed people to move from the agricultural age to the mercantile age. The other fundamental invention in that period was the clock. Because before that, and this is so hard for us to imagine, but imagine a world where your brain does not think about time, that you don't have any conceptualization of time. You just wake up in the morning and you do your work and you go to bed at night, but you don't really, you don't plan your day. You don't plan what's going to happen next week, what's going to happen next month, what's going to happen in 5 years. It's hard for us to imagine that, but in an agricultural age, that was not something your brain thought about or even had the capacity to think about. And then we invented clocks, and clocks suddenly could measure time. And then you could begin to think about, you know, well, this afternoon at 5 o'clock, I'm going to meet someone and do this, or I'm, you know, you could start to plan time. And that was essential for a mercantile age, because the mercantile age had to do with, okay, I'm gonna have a shop. It's going to be open 5 days a week. I've got to think in days of the week. I'm going to be open from 9 to 5. I've got to think in times of the day. I've got to start conceptualizing time and imagining my life as these units of time that are being measured and being parsed out and occupied by what I'm doing. The movement from an agricultural age to a mercantile age meant people had to change their brain. And the map and the clock were devices for human beings rewiring their brains so they start to think about the world in a different spatial sense and in a different temporal sense. And that then began to enable trade and began to enable moving into a mercantile age. But we had to reshape our brains as human beings to do that. The same thing happened when the movement from the mercantile age to the industrial age. One of the fundamental tools that changed there was numbers. If you're going to begin to have engineering and you're going to understand how to do things, how to make machines and industrial products, you had to begin to think of how do we quantify. And, you know, just the shift at a certain point in the Western world from Roman numerals to Arabic numbers enabled us to use our brain in a completely different way. Now we can actually conceptualize numerical problems, word problems, and solve problems with numbers and equations in ways that hadn't been possible before. That's a new brain capability that people didn't freaking have before that. And in order to move into an era where we began to think of machines and devices and inventions, we had to have that ability to think through quantification and numbers. The same thing moving from an industrial age to an organizational age. Suddenly we had to get huge numbers of the population literate. Before that, people didn't know how to read and write. Some people, of course, but you know, it was a tiny proportion, knew how to read and write. Most people didn't need to know how to read and write. And then moving into the organizational age, we had to have all this communication. We had all these organizations where people could, you know, send memos back and forth and make plans and have strategies. And, you know, all of that organizational age required literacy. And that meant that large numbers of human beings had to learn how to read. I mean, this is a... I mean, it's incredibly difficult in the 21st century to imagine how complicated it is to learn to read, to make your brain read. And now we think of it as pretty much everybody knows how to read, but that is a brain capability that for millennia, most human beings' brains did not know how to read. And it's about neuronal connections. How do you make neuronal connections that allow you to read? I mean, there was a huge shift between spoken language and written language. And there even were arguments that, you know, back in Roman times, there was an argument between Socrates and Plato. Because the old way was that everything was oral language. And people memorized. You know, when you made a speech, you would memorize a speech. And everything was done orally. And communication was oral because people didn't know how to read. And there was a thought that maybe something's going to be lost in your brain capability if you can't memorize. Putting things down written, it's a crutch. You shouldn't be relying on written language. You need to keep it all in your head. You need to have this phenomenal memory. And yet there was the argument, well, no written language would allow us to have access to so much more than our brain could hold. But that reshaping your brain so that you can read as opposed to understand language that's oral is enormous. How do you get your brain to understand that those letters combined in those words strung together in sentences, have meaning? And, you know, I've got two grandchildren now, and unbelievable to watch these little bitty brains, because when human beings come out, they don't know. Their brain can't do that. And it takes a lot of work for that little kid to shape their brain, make those neuronal connections so that they can read. And even the difference between reading aloud, and there's this funny thing of, you know, this 5 or 6 or 7 year old, see Dick run, you know, and they're reading aloud because you can't immediately read silently. Your brain can't do that. First, it has to learn to read aloud. Hear those words like that kid's accustomed to hearing words, get the meaning from them that way. And then it's another transition to be able to read silently, to be able to get all that meaning without verbalizing. And then it's another level entirely to be able to do deep reading, where you're completely immersed in the reading. And it's like vicariously, you're living in the world of those words and that book. And that's another kind of brain capability that you either develop or you don't develop. Now, to move into the organizational age, we had to up our game, make our brains capable of doing reading in particular at a level that human beings had never been able to do reading before. Be able to read long treatises and to understand them and to absorb them and to communicate in these complicated ways. Okay, so if we can see that when we move from the agricultural age to the mercantile age, when we move from the mercantile age to the industrial age, when we move from the industrial age to the organizational age, what are the new brain capabilities that are required to move to a creative age? And are you shaping your freaking brain to have those capabilities? Or are you not shaping your brain to have those capabilities as we move forward? So a lot of what the second half of the course is about is what kinds of brain capabilities does it take to be a creative person? And how is that different from the kind of brain you need for an organizational age? And again, I'm not like selling this for everyone. Richard Florida says 30% of the population currently is in the creative sector. 70% is not in the creative sector. So they're using brain capabilities that are there for the organizational age, some of them the industrial age, some of them the mercantile age, whatever. But 30% of the population is in this new way of thinking, and their brains have to work that way. And I'll tell you, when Google goes out to hire somebody, what they're looking for is a certain kind of brain. And it's amazing these days, the difference in HR, the difference in hiring practices, especially in more progressive companies. It used to be, look at their resume. You know, what kinds of educational background do they have? What was their GPA? What does their letter of recommendation say? Are they a dependable employee? Blah, 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 blah. But nowadays, a lot of times when you're interviewing for a lot of these cool jobs, they're going to put you in a room with four other applicants, and they're going to give you a project and say, you've got 2 hours, the four of you work together and come up with something, and they're going to watch you, and they're going to see how your brain works, and they're going to see how you collaborate, and they're going to see how you think, because those things are important for the kind of job they're looking for. And it's unbelievable to me the amount of time and effort that goes into hiring some people for some of these jobs these days. My younger son got a job offer from YouTube. The process, oh my God, the process he went through to get that job offer from YouTube was unbelievable. And all of these, they're testing. They're trying to see what kind of brain do you have. Do you have the kind of brain that works in the creative age and works well here? And that's different from what's on your freaking resume. Where'd you get your degree from? That's the entry point to the process. But after that, it's all about then, I want to know how your brain works. Okay, so I don't know. Let's have a little discussion here. And I am so completely comfortable with somebody saying, Spec, I think that's bullshit. Or Spec, I'm not interested in being a part of that. That doesn't feel right for me. I want you to be thinking about that yourself, but I'm also interested in your reaction to, is your educational process creating the kind of brain you think is important for the creative age? How do you do that? Is this an important thing? That you're in freaking college, you're trying to educate yourself, you're trying to shape your brain. What are the brain capabilities that we ought to be working on? So I don't know. You got a reaction, you got an opinion here. Come on. You're bound to be thinking something. What's inside your head? Yeah, there are a few people I can always depend on. I'm trying to get inside the head of the rest of you. Yeah, what do you think?
I think that, generally speaking, our education system doesn't make brains that are as developed for the creative age as maybe we could be. I think that, like, grading systems are like classic carrot stick motivation, and that's not necessarily the best for creativity.
That's cool. Good point. So actually gleaning from previous readings and what we've been doing, yeah, maybe there's other ways, and then maybe you need to think yourself, how do I make sure I'm getting intrinsic motivation, motivation 3.0, motivation that's appropriate in a creative age, and, you know, how can I make sure I'm developing that? Excellent. Fresh meat. A new voice back here. Okay, what do you think?
I think in our education system, we have a lot of learning for a test, like cramming and then forgetting about it instead of thinking through a process like in multi various ways of like where it builds on something. And I think that when you like just cram for something, then you just kind of like don't really develop your brain as much. So I think that's one of the major flaws in like how we learn now.
So actually, in a subsequent lecture, we're going to talk about that whole notion of memory dump, short-term memory, long-term memory. And it is very easy to wire your brain so that it's really good at absorbing in short-term memory. And that's a different part of your brain you're putting it in. You're putting it there in short-term memory. You get to that test. You do the memory dump. 2 days later, I ask you those very same questions, and you don't have a clue. It's gone. And you're like, dude, wait. 2 days ago, I knew that, and now I don't know it. And that's just understanding how your brain works, and you can get very, very adept and make a brain that's really good at that short-term memory and that, you know, absorption and memory dump. But I don't know. In the long term, is that what I really need? Is that what's really helpful? Is that the kind of brain I think I need moving forward? Yes. Let me see if I can get over here.
So what do you think?
Well, I just kind of want to piggyback off of what we were just saying. I think it would be interesting to have a class that was had tests that were formatted as, you know, you can have your notes out, but you're really testing the thinking process and how people synthesize the information from the class. Mm-hmm. I think that would be an interesting concept instead of just, you know, having 80% of it memorization.
Mm-hmm. I'm all over this. And, you know, so my other class that I teach, Architecture and Society, big lecture class, and in this class, we don't do any multiple choice questions. We don't do any, it's not a lot of this memorization kind of thing that you did in this class. But in that class, 20% of every test is definitely that, and another 30% is sort of that. And then 50% of the test is, how do you think? But I have been thinking of dumping that 20% and that 30%. I have a colleague here who teaches in the history department. Anybody had a class from H.W. Brand? Yeah, you've had it. Only one. So I hear from him and hear secondhand, but I think he's into a completely different way of testing. So he does tons and tons of pop quizzes in class. So, you know, you lecture for 15 minutes, and then you ask people to, did you hear what I just said the last 15 minutes? Or are you, you know, not absorbing anything? And maybe you're even taking notes, but you're not actually absorbing it. You're just recording it and hoping that you'll be able to then review those for the test and know something in the future and then do that memory dump. And he's been teaching history for a really long time, and he's a really, really smart guy. And he basically is saying, I realize that people don't remember it. You know, 5 years later, they don't know what I taught in that class. And so that's not working. So this pop quiz thing is to try to get you to absorb it right now. Did you hear it? Did you absorb it? Do you remember it right now? And that he thinks, is establishing that information more deeply in the brain than this other process of taking notes, studying the notes, doing the memory dump on the test, and then 2 days later, not remembering anything. But what he's really trying to do is adjust to people's brains in the creative age, because that really worked perfectly well, that old system. That worked perfectly well in the organizational age. But we'll talk more about this, but your brains are being shaped by other technologies like the internet, like your smartphone. And so we've got to think of how do we learn in that era, and how do we test, and how do we establish long-term memory. So all of that's going to be meat for discussion through this second half of the class. Today, we want to do an expansion of the original 10 terms that we looked at. In the first half of the class, we talked about these extensively. What is problem solving? What is indeterminacy? What is design, invention? What is creativity? How does independent thinking work? What is a vision? How do values factor into this? What is the importance of confidence, of rebellion? Those 10 terms, we'll continue to talk about them some, but we're really going to move on to 10 new terms. And these 10 new terms expand maybe what we're talking about in terms of creative problem solving. So for the rest of the lecture today, we're going to go over these 10 new terms. Another thing that I should make sure we're clear about here, we do not have class in here next Tuesday. Instead, we're having class in the Blanton Museum on Saturday. And I think you were told about that in your discussion section last Tuesday. But in your discussion section, your TA gave you a time that your group should be in the Blanton. So there's a group at 11, another group at 12, another group at 1, another group at 2, I think. Anyway, we have 4 sessions there, each of them about an hour long. And in those, we are going to be talking about exactly this topic. Now, one of the things that UGS classes are meant to do is expose you to
the riches of this university, and it's an incredible university with lots and lots of riches. And so the Blanton Museum is one of those riches, and so this is part of that effort to expose you to some of the resources of the larger university. But I don't like to just check the box on that. I always am looking for, is there a way that we can use the Blanton Museum to teach you something about creative problem solving? Can we use the Humanities Research Center to learn something about creative problem solving? So there's a current changing exhibit over there, which is fantastic. And so we're going to go over there for just a short period of time on Saturday and just expose you to this notion of how do I use this resource of the Blanton Museum to increase my creative problem solving? How do I use it as a way of understanding creativity better through the medium of art, which is what they're doing there? So we'll have just a little hour-long session, and we will not have class next Tuesday to enable you to attend this session on Saturday. Of course, some people are going to have conflicts. We understand that. Talk about that with your TA. We're not going to be horsey about that. We understand. But, and we'll figure out something for you to do as a substitute. But generally, this is a really important session having to do with creative problem solving. And I wish we could spend a lot more time over there than we'll be able to. Yeah.
Notes while we're there?
Question is, do you need to take notes? Yeah, Jesus, I don't know. Maybe you want to take notes, maybe you don't want to take notes. Will you be tested on it? Probably not. Will it possibly be something that in one of the essays on your test you might refer to, you might reinforce a point you make with it? Absolutely, but kind of up to you. Yeah?
I was just asking because last time I went to the Blanton, they don't really like backpacks there, so.
Yeah, you can stick it in a locker and take your pen and paper or whatever. But, you know, honestly, let's just say don't bring anything. Just bring your full attention, and let's just try to use our brains for that hour in the Blanton Museum. And this exhibit is just, it's like they custom made it for us to make a certain point in this class. So I'm really excited about the conversation we can have in the Blanton on Saturday. But so in this second half, we're looking at these 10 new terms. And so I'm going to walk you through the 10 new terms today. And then these will come up as with the 10 initial terms. They'll come up over and over in lectures subsequently. So these are the 10 new terms: optimism, hybridization, collaboration, teamwork, leadership, power, mentorship, competition, craft, and extrapolation. And each of those is going to have a particular meaning in the context of creative problem solving and how we make ourselves more effective as creative problem solvers. So this first thing is optimism. And this is, optimism is a kind of mindset. It's an outlook on life. There definitely are some people who would immediately say I'm an optimistic person. There's some people who would immediately say I'm a pessimistic person. I can remember when I was a little kid, my father used to always say that my older brother was the pessimist and I was the optimist. And that whenever anything came up, he was seeing the reasons why that wasn't going to work and we couldn't do that. And I was always seeing, no, we can do that. We can do, you know, always optimistic. So maybe it's kind of a personality, you know, even as a little kid, you have some qualities of optimism or pessimism. But I think we'll be talking about through the rest of the semester, the benefits of optimism in creative problem solving as a mindset or an outlook on life. So the dictionary definition of optimism is a disposition or tendency to look at the more favorable side of happenings and to anticipate the most favorable result. Anticipating the most favorable result. Do you anticipate a favorable result? Or do you anticipate that things are not going to turn out well. And optimism is an important tool if, in fact, you do anticipate the most favorable result. Another different dictionary definition, optimism is the belief that good ultimately predominates over evil in the world. Good ultimately predominates over evil in the world. Now, I want to emphasize that all of these things we talk about in this class are tools for creative problem solving. Do you have to use every tool in the tool chest? No. Some people are going to use some tools. Some people are going to use other tools. But this particular tool kind of requires that you believe that good ultimately predominates over evil. If you want to use this tool, you have to develop that kind of mindset. So optimism is one of the things we're going to be talking about a good bit. Both Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson were classic optimists. And that was very key in their creative problem solving. When they had this vision, they actually believed that it's going to happen. They were optimistic that I can make this happen. Even though there might have been odds that would say it wouldn't happen. I mean, to be a revolutionary, you have to be an optimist. You have to say, our good idea is going to dominate over the evil of the British government and the king. You have to believe that good is going to dominate over evil. And that's what fueled them to be a part of the Revolutionary War. So optimism for them, for both of them, it was a very, very important tool. We're going to be talking in the latter half of the class here about this guy, Guglielmo Marconi. Oh, my God. I love this guy to death. He's just such an interesting character. This is the guy who invented wireless technology. Everything we do these days with the cloud and with, Wi-Fi and everything we do really goes back to Guglielmo Marconi understanding wireless technology. It was, for him, it was telegraphy. How can I make a telegraph go through the air instead of through a wire? And then that led to radio, which then sound could go through the air instead of through a wire. It was understanding electromagnetic waves. It's basic physics. But the weird thing is, the guy had no training in science. He had no training in physics. He would never have called himself a scientist or a physicist. But he was an experimenter. He had ideas, and he tried them out, and he had phenomenal optimism. He constantly believed, I've got this idea. I think this is going to work. I think this is going to work. And even though he failed, and he failed, and he failed, he was still optimistic. This was the number one tool for Guglielmo Marconi. The guy won the freaking Nobel Prize for Physics in 1908, and he wasn't even a physicist, but he had optimism, and this was a powerful, powerful tool for him. Okay, second new term is hybridization. We're going to totally talk about this in the Blanton on Saturday. But hybridization, where you take two things that don't belong together and you conjoin them and you get a whole new thing that didn't exist before. That's true creativity. You get a whole new thing because you hybridize two things that don't normally go together. So it's about crossover. It's often about interdisciplinarity, taking an idea from one discipline and crossbreeding it with an idea from another discipline. These things don't normally go together, but if you conjoin them, they suddenly produce a new, fresh, creative thing. It's about conjuncture, where things really become one that previously were two completely separate things. So the dictionary definition here, hybrid is anything derived from heterogeneous sources or composed of elements of different or incongruous kinds. So heterogeneous sources, not sources that are logically the same, but can you draw on very different sources? And then that notion of incongruous, things that are not supposed to go together, But when you put them together, it makes something new that didn't exist before. So that is, we're going to be talking about that in the Blanton in terms of how it makes art. But this notion of a composite or formed of a composition of heterogeneous elements, a lot of different pieces that came from different sources, and they combine somehow to make a composite, to make something that's new and fresh and creative. Ralph Waldo Emerson has this fantastic quote. I love this quote. A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. If we think that we need to be consistent, if we think that we have to use sources that are related, if we think that things have to be easily categorized into consistent pods of knowledge, then our mind is too small. A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. Big minds combine things in a way that is not consistent, and that's what makes big ideas. We're going to be looking next week on Thursday at a guy who's the poster child for hybridization. This guy, Norman Bel Geddes, who, oh my God, you can't even find a label for this guy. He was a transportation planner, and he had a huge impact on the interstate highway system in the United States. He also designed, he basically invented streamlining in the 1930s and 1940s, but this kind of design ethic that looked dynamic and streamlined. That photograph at the top there, he invented a car that was also an airplane, so the wings would fold up and you'd drive on the highway, and then when you needed it to, the wings would fold down and it would become an airplane. Wait, cars are one thing, airplanes are another thing. These are not supposed to go together. But he's constantly someone who hybridizes. He takes two disparate things because he thinks in such an interdisciplinary way. He's constantly super, super inventive. This is one of the most creative individuals I've ever studied. He's phenomenal. So those first two, optimism and hybridization. We're going to talk about them a lot in the second half of the class. The next five key terms have to do with relinquishing complete control. And that's the idea of, okay, it's not just about you. We do creative problem solving in a context of other people. And how does our interaction with other people affect creative problem solving? But now we're not in complete control. So the first of these is collaboration. And collaboration is a particular kind of interaction with other people. The dictionary definition is to work with one another, to cooperate. So this is where we're in this together, and we're kind of working as one. Two people, three people, five people, collaborating and working as one. So it's seeking out resources beyond ourselves. Now we're able to get a wider range of perceptions and values and visions, and sometimes that enriches the gene pool here. It means increasing resources to accomplish this that might be impossible individually. You couldn't bring everything to the table that a larger group could bring. It's about getting information and inspiration from someone else. Are you able to get information and inspiration from someone else? Is that a key tool for you in creative problem solving? Working off of someone else in a true collaborative environment that we're all working on this together. So we like to think of Albert Einstein as this lone genius. And it's just sickening to me that he's portrayed as this guy who, this kind of nerdy guy who goes in a room and he just, you know, figures everything out and voila, the theory of relativity. That's actually not the way it worked at all. In the period when he was developing the theory of relativity, two people were hugely important in his life. And he's talking with them day to day, hour to hour, And he's developing that theory of relativity along with them. One of them was Miliva Merrick, the woman in the photograph on the left. He was not married to Miliva Merrick. They were lovers while they were in school. She got a PhD in physics at the same time he did, same university, ETH. And they had a baby together and then eventually did get married. But he was hugely dependent on Miliva Merrick. Miliva Merrick was his sounding board. And she's a super smart woman. She's getting her PhD in physics same time he is. And constantly back and forth exchanging ideas. And she's not credited with nearly as much as she should be, but he was having this dialogue and collaborating back and forth with Miliva Merrick the entire time he was working on that. Then on the slide on the right, the guy there is Michelangelo Basso, an Italian guy who also was in his PhD program at ETH. And, you know, Einstein was good at mathematics. There's this whole rumor that he, like, failed calculus when he was in high school. No, no, no. That was all wrong. He was super good at mathematics. But he wasn't extraordinary at mathematics. He wasn't, like, the very, very top echelon in mathematics. And when he started working on the theory of relativity, he needed more math capability than he had. And Michelangelo Basso was a much better mathematician than he was. So the actual proof and the kind of validation of some of these ideas was dependent very heavily on Michelangelo Basso. So it's collaboration that led to that fundamental creative discovery. It wasn't just what was available in Albert Einstein's mind. Okay, a second of these five terms that have to do with relinquishing complete control is teamwork. It's one step farther than collaboration. It's becoming part of a group effort. Now, teamwork is different than collaboration, substantially different. The definition of team is a coordinated effort on the part of a group of persons acting together in the interests of a common cause. The key thing here is coordinated. When we're collaborating, we're all acting as one. When we're working as a team, it's coordinating. You do this, I do this, she does that, he does this. On a team, somebody's the quarterback, somebody's the halfback, somebody's the right guard, somebody's the left end. Each of those people has a different role to play. It's coordinated. We're not all doing the same thing. We're all doing different things, but we're joined together and coordinated as a team. And we're after then accomplishing a common cause together. So sometimes problems are just so big that you can't do it as an individual. You have to have a team that's doing it. We're going to be looking at this guy, John Stevens. He was instrumental in doing the Panama Canal, which we see in the bottom photograph there. Constructing the Panama Canal is too big a job for one person to lead. It took a team to lead that. And he was masterful at constructing and executing the work of a team. Different roles for different people, complementary skills, so that somebody's able to do this, and that complements someone else. They're not doing the same thing. Managing, coordinating, orchestrating all of these various players together. Again, the ability to work in a team is a tool. It's a capability. And you can make yourself better at creative problem solving if you understand how to work on a team. And so we'll be talking about how teamwork is a tool for creative problem solving. Okay, let's see. Okay, so the next term is leadership. Maybe this is one step further than teamwork, is this idea of leadership. How do you become someone who goes beyond just being part of a team and actually takes a role of leadership? So the dictionary definition of leadership is to go before or with, to show the way, how you, you know, what direction things are going. We got the next one up. Okay. To influence or to induce is leadership. Okay, so there again, this is a tool that you can use in creative problem solving to make yourself better at it or not as good at it. So influencing or inducing, another dictionary definition, to guide in direction, course, action, or opinion. So again, this notion of leadership is guiding the process. This is what John Stevens did in the case of the Panama Canal. There was a team, and he was part of that team, but beyond the team, he was the leader. And he was a genius. And in fact, there would not be a Panama Canal if it were not for the leadership of John Stevens. This was not over a huge, long period of time. He simply came in for about 3 years, and he led that team, and he made that, put that thing on the right path and made that happen. So that was a very important tool for solving that problem of how do we build this enormous canal between the two oceans. Both Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson were phenomenal leaders. They were able to use their personal charisma, to use their, in Thomas Jefferson's case in particular, his articulateness, his ability to use words as a way of leading, and writing the Declaration of Independence was a moment of complete leadership in that regard. So leadership is another important element. Power is another of these five elements that are about relinquishing complete control. The definition of power is great or marked ability to do or act. It's strength or might or force. Power is usually a little controversial in this class. Some people see power as a bad word. Power has its role, I think. Maybe not a tool for everybody, but power is the possession of control or command over others, authority or ascendancy, the ability to actually go beyond leadership, where you actually have the power to make something happen. And we're going to look at this very interesting guy, Robert Moses. Oh my God, I mean, he's a little bit of a controversial character too. He solved some problems in New York City. Urban design and recreational problems, the city growing like crazy, lots of immigrant population, a lot of poor people that are coming in, and they're not living in healthy conditions, and they're not able to get fresh air, and their kids are not able to do sports and recreation. And he says, this is not right, this is a problem, we need to solve this. And he had some really great ideas, and he wrote all these white papers, and he lobbied with the political powers that be, and it didn't work. He didn't solve the problem. The kids are still poor. They're not getting recreation. There are terrible sanitary conditions. And then he figured out, nope, what I need to use is power. I have to have political power. If I don't have power, I don't solve the problem. And so I'm just saying, sometimes there are problems where you need power. And in his case, he used money, and he used information, sometimes intrigue, to get the power to be able to solve the problem. But without the power, he was not going to be able to solve that problem. So we might, and again, I'm perfectly happy with some people saying, you know, power's not for me. That's not a tool I'm even interested in exploring. It's just off the table for me. But there may be other people that say, I get it. I want to be able to acquire that tool of how do you use power. Another of these, the last of these five, is mentorship. And that's maybe going beyond just solving this problem, but really beginning to affect the next generation of creative problem solving, influencing the next generation, creating the capability beyond yourself. The definition of a mentor is a wise and trusted counselor. The word mentor actually comes from the Odyssey, the Greek literature. In Greek literature, the Odyssey. In the Odyssey, Odysseus is going off on this trip, and he has a friend who he wants to take care of his son. His son, Telemachus, is being left behind. He's worried about, you know, he's going to be gone for a long time. I'm not going to be there to raise him and to train him, and so I need somebody else to help out here. He calls on his friend Mentor to help him with Telemachus, and Mentor does that, and that's how we get the term mentorship. It's named after that character in the Odyssey. So mentoring, we can see in a lot of creative problem solvers either the role they play as a mentor or the importance of mentoring for them. We talked about both Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton were mentored very thoroughly by George Washington. He became almost like a father figure for both of them. That mentorship was absolutely critical in their growth. And then the other word that has to do with this interaction with other people is competition. And again, this may be one that some people decide, I like this, this is a great tool for me. Some people may decide not so much. But competition, in terms of the dictionary definition, is struggle or rivalry for supremacy, so that you're actually trying to be better than the other person. You're trying to reach supremacy over someone else. Another dictionary definition, it's rivalry for an object desired in common, usually resulting in a victor and a loser or losers, but not necessarily involving the destruction of the latter. You can have competition without destroying the other person or entity, but it does have to do with being a victor or a rivalry that desires the same object for two people, and somebody's going to win and somebody's going to lose, but not necessarily involving the destruction of the other person. Again, we're going to look at a case study here of Jonas Salk on the right and Albert Sabin on the left. These were two scientists, both of them trying desperately to find a vaccine for polio. This was a huge scourge, a huge health problem in the United States in particular in the 1950s. And they're both virologists. This is right in their wheelhouse, and they're trying to find a solution. They both have the same common goal, and both of them want to get to the finish line first. They had very different approaches to how you would do it. One said you need to use a killed virus vaccine. One said you need to use a live virus vaccine. So they're going completely different paths, but they're trying to accomplish the same goal. The competition was fierce. They actually hated each other. They were mean and evil and wicked to each other. They were fighting for the same funding sources for their laboratories, and they needed that funding. But that competition probably got a vaccine for polio 5 years faster than it would have if there had been no competition. And the funding sources were encouraging the competition because they realized this is making everyone more productive. Sometimes this is a way for creative problem solving to amp up if there is some competition that exists there. Okay, the ninth term of these 10 new terms is craft. And we're using craft here to mean are you attentive? Are you working hard? Are you doing your homework? Are you really, and a lot of this is that first step of research, are you doing this super thoroughly? Is your craft good? And the dictionary definition there is to craft is to make with skill and careful attention to detail. So sometimes an important tool in creative problem solving is that careful attention to detail. Another dictionary definition has to do with skills, knowledge, abilities, care, commitment, attentiveness. All of these are elements of craft. Are you really committed and intent and thoroughly involved in it? We're going to look at another case study of this farmer in Virginia named Joel Salatin. And this is an ecological farmer. His creative problem solving has to do with how do you farm things without destroying the environment, which mega farms are doing these days in parts of the U.S. How do you farm and farm productively and profitably, but not rob the soil of nutrition and not create a deleterious pollution problems in the water and in the air, and create food that is nutritionally rich and that doesn't have a lot of chemical content. And so he's into all those. That's the problem he wants to solve. And the guy just, his craft is phenomenal. He's just a hard worker. He understands the science. He understands agriculture. He understands nutrition. He really did his homework on all of that. And then he makes these kind of badass inventions. The one on the bottom there is his, I forget what he calls it, like the henmobile or something like that. So all of his hens go there to roost at night and lay their eggs. And that's how he gets his eggs from them. But it's on a vehicle so that while they're roosting and laying their eggs, they're also pooping like crazy. Chickens produce incredibly, incredibly high quantities of shit. And it's extremely high in nitrates, which is very good fertilizer. So this is, he's able to just move that thing every day, and he fertilizes this piece of the field, and then he moves it, and he fertilizes the next piece of the field, the next piece of the field. And so he's able to make that ecological cycle of increasing the nutrition in the soil and disposing of the waste of the chickens. And that's what industrial chicken production just does not get at all. And instead, the nitrates are pollutants, and there is no giving back to soil or enrichment. So he's kind of making that cycle work. But it's through craft, and it's just through a whole lot of hard work that he does that. The tenth and final term is extrapolation. The dictionary definition of that is extrapolation is to infer that which is not known from that which is known. It's conjecture. And this is putting yourself out on the line. It is conjecture. It's imagining something. And it relates to three of our earlier terms where we talked about risk-taking and rebellion and confidence. Extrapolation means that you're not being able to found this on fact. You're taking a step into the abyss. And that's really what happened in the case of Jonas Salk, and that's what made him win the competition for a vaccine for polio, because unlike most scientists, he was comfortable with extrapolation, with something that he couldn't prove, but still he went that way, even though he couldn't prove it. He extrapolated. Okay, Twitter.